This is Karen Park. It's June 3rd, 1993. I'm with Mr. Charles Wright in the offices of Bullivant Hauser Bailey, and this is the fourth session of his oral history. Mr. Wright, when we last left our last session, we were discussing your house on Vista Road. Do you want to just wrap that up, because we got sort of cut off?
Yes, the house was located really on Southwest Myrtle Street, right off Vista Avenue, about two blocks below the Ainsworth School. At that time, both of our children, my son Frederick and my daughter Hilda, were going to the Hillside School, which later became part of the Catlin Gable School. And the Hillside School was really the lower school department of the Catlin School at that time, before it merged with the Gable School. And my wife and I were discussing whether we should send our children to public schools or private schools. And we had the theory that it might be better to go to private school in the early stages of their education, where they got good study habits, rather than later on sending them to a private school. But during the course of Fred's going to Hillside School, there weren't many boys there, and we thought we'd better take him out and put him into Ainsworth School, and we did. And we found that he wasn't being challenged, and that the teaching at the Ainsworth School was inferior to the teaching at the Catlin School, Hillside School. So at the end of a trial year, we took him out and put him back into the Catlin School. When he graduated from the Catlin School, the Hillside Department of the Catlin School, we decided he wanted to go to Lincoln High School. And that's where he went, and he received an excellent education there. They had, at the time he entered Lincoln High School, they had what they call the Ford Foundation Grant for accelerated studies for some of the students. And Fred got into a very good mathematics class, and a good Latin class, and a good French class. And by the time he graduated from Lincoln High School, he was awarded one of the national scholarships to Yale. But because of my income, it was just an honor. I mean, he didn't get the stipend that went with it. But it showed what a good education he had had at Lincoln High School. And he later on majored in mathematics, and then became a teacher of mathematics, and is now head of the mathematics department at the Lakeside School in Seattle, which is a private secondary school. And that was where one of his prized students was, William Gates, who was the president of Microsoft. And Fred had quite a time with both Gates and Allen, because they were so intent on going ahead, and they managed to break the Boeing code. And Fred had to have them go to Boeing and tell them that they'd managed to break that code, and they were not fired from the school at that time, but they were told to be more careful in the future.
And that's Paul Allen,
Paul Allen, who's now head of the Blazers. I mean, he bought the Blazers, but he has his own company. He split off from Microsoft after several years. But he's a billionaire himself, and so is Bill Gates.
Did you send your daughters also to private
school? We sent both Hilda and Elizabeth to Catlin School. And then when Catlin merged with the Gable School, which was another private school here in Portland, they continued on with the Catlin Gable School. That time I was on the board of the Catlin School, later on of the Catlin Gable School. And I remember when Mr. Cabell, who was the president of the board, said that he wanted me to do a little pro bono work. I may have mentioned this before, to handle the merger of Catlin and Gable School. And the Oregon legislature had just passed an act which authorized charitable corporations to merge. Up to that time, there had been no, this was in the 50s, as I recall, and so I had known the corporation commissioner down in Oregon for a number of years through the SEC and also through work in corporations and in private practice, Frank Haley, and he was a remarkable man. He was blind right from birth, and he could find his way around, and he made one of the best careers as a corporation commissioner that I've known. Anyway, I called him and said, asked him to send me the forms that they had prepared for merger of charitable corporations. And he said, Charles, we don't have any forms. You go ahead and draft your forms, send them down to me, and I'll take a look. So I drafted the forms, and after a few sessions together, well, they worked out. And so then I held my breath after the merger to be sure that it had all worked and that the real property had gotten into the proper corporation and so forth. Anyway, it came out all right.
And it's still Catlin Gable School.
It's still Catlin Gable School, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have just a few follow-up questions mm-hmm. from our previous sessions. When we were discussing your law school years, you mentioned some problems confronting the legal profession from the business sector. Can you describe those?
Well, I think this was when I was studying under William O. Douglas.
Yes.
And I don't know whether I mentioned the courses that he taught there, but there was corporation, organizations, management, and finance, and reorganization. Anyway, on the financial side, the news media and other media had many comments to make on the public utility companies at that time, and they were exploiting the public and selling watered securities to them, and they were also monopolistic, and William O. Douglas felt that these were nefarious practices, and he hoped someday there'd be some legislation that would take care of it. And there was the sale of securities, whether it was for public utility companies or other corporations, had no supervision. They had to depend upon the old fraud laws to get redress when securities were sold through misrepresentation. And those were problems that were coming up and just being discussed all the time while I was in law school. And it was after I graduated from law school when President Roosevelt got hold of Douglas and Abe Fortas, and the two of them really wrote the Federal Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934. And then later on, there was a Trust Indenture Act of 1939. I don't think that Douglas had so much to do with that, because by that time, I think he was one of the commissioners.
I see. You also mentioned attending grade school, or was it high school, with Gus Solomon?
In high school. I didn't know him in high school at all.
But you just knew who he was.
I knew who he was. I knew he was a very bright student. And he was a singularly homely person, very homely, and I think he had sort of a tough time being Jewish and not being very handsome when he was at high school. I got to know him after I returned from law school, because he was a great friend of Alan Hart. Alan Hart later became a partner in our firm, and now is in the firm of, Lindsay Hart and Weigler. Anyway, Alan and Gus and I used to have lunch together frequently during my early years with the Platt firm. Mm-hmm. And after I went to Seattle, I would occasionally see Gus when I came to Portland. And then I can't remember when he was appointed to the bench, but I remember hearing from Allen that he, there was a, they had a very tough interrogation of him in the Senate because he had a reputation for being very liberal, and there was sort of a atmosphere of that time, the McCarthy era, and anybody suspected of being liberal was also suspected of being communist. And it was only through the efforts of some of the finest lawyers in Portland that Gus got appointed. I remember Charles Hart, and people don't know much about him nowadays, but he was the head of the firm that now stole Reeves. And it was Hart, Spencer, McCullough, Rockwood, and Davies. And Charles Hart was probably the preeminent trial lawyer in Portland in those days. And he went back to Washington and testified in favor of Gus Solomon, and I think it had a great effect.
Was Judge Solomon in front of the un-American activities?
Yes, and he was also, you mean by that, he was being accused by the un-American.
Yes.
And also, he was, I think there was an organization of lawyers. What was the name of that liberal organization, you remember?
ACLU?
The American Civil Liberty.
National Lawyers Guild.
That's it, the National Lawyers Guild. And he was the organizer of the local chapter here. And he was also prominent in the ACLU. So those were the things that that militated against his appointment. And then he became a very excellent judge. I think he always was able to zero in on the crucial issues. I think there may have been a slight prejudicial side to Judge Solomon. There were certain elements in the legal profession, the conservative, hyper-conservative, and he would sometimes, I think, let that influence him when he was on the bench, especially in the treatment of lawyers from some of those firms. But, of course, I always got along very well with him just because I'd known him so well. And I had several cases before him in years after I came back into private practice, and I remember we were the attorneys for the First National Bank at the time that the Klamath Indians were given their freedom from the tribal limitations, and there was legislation which allowed the members of the Klamath tribe to receive certain amount of money from the sale of their timberlands, and it was felt that that many of them should be protected and that there should be trusts established, and they had the U.S. National Bank and the First National Bank were named as trustees, and that legislation was challenged by a lawyer down in Klamath Falls, saying that it was unconstitutional, and I handled that case for the First National Bank before Judge Solomon, and he upheld the legislation. Later on, I had another case which involved minor members of the Klamath tribe, and the legislation protecting the miners also established these trusts, but had provisions for the continuation of the trust past their age of majority. And Gus Solomon chopped that off. He said that that was invalid, that portion of it. And through the years, I've had other cases before Judge Solomon, that came out all right.
You had also had a personal relationship with him?
Yes, right? And not particularly a social relationship, though he and his wife had come out to our house for dinner, and we'd been to their house for dinner. But I would see him from time to time, and very often I'd stop in at his chambers and talk to him.
Mm-hmm. Through law school and your early career, can you distinguish any especially formative experiences or influences, or were there any setbacks or hardships for you?
Well, on formative experience, I think that it was just most of the professors that I studied under at Yale Law School were very able and very demanding, and they I think instilled in their students the desire for not perfection, but excellence in the work that they did and in the writing that they did. And I think that had a very profound effect on the student body, and including myself. And they also were a little progressive in having what we call now seminars and so forth, instead of just lectures before a large body of students. And it was a more personal relationship with the professors at the Yale Law School, whereas at Harvard they had these huge classes and they'd flunk maybe half of them out after the first year, which I thought always was a sort of a waste of the teaching effort.
But I think they still do that today.
I think they still do, yes. You see that TV show, you know?
That's right.
The setbacks, I think, came at the end of my legal career when I was trying to get a job, and it was in the depth of the Depression. See, I graduated in 1932, and I didn't take the bars till 1933. I studied for those myself. I didn't go to any bar course.
Did they have bar review courses?
They had a bar review course, but I didn't go to it because I didn't have a job at that time, and so I just studied at home. But I got a job before I passed the bar, and that was with that Platt firm. And I was in a sort of trepidation for fear I might not get through the bar exam. And there was a certain reputation about people from the Ivy League law schools flunking the bar, even though they graduated from Harvard or Yale or Michigan and so forth. We were a little fearful. Anyway, at that time, I may have mentioned that when you passed the bar, they sent you a telegram. So when I got that telegram, I was very relieved. And so was Mr. Platt, I think.
Did they send you something different if you did not pass the bar?
I don't know. I just think there was no message whatsoever. I think you looked at the paper and for the list of names, and if you weren't on there, you knew you hadn't passed. That's the way I remember it, anyway.
Not passing the bar exam really is kind of a fairly common occurrence these days. The first time around, was it so when
no,
you took the bar?
I don't think it was, because those who took it the second time, or I don't know how many times they were allowed at the time I got out of law school, but very often they'd flunk the second time around. So there wasn't so much, I think, of that as there is now.
How do you feel about the change in the rule now that you can take the bar exam as many times as it takes for you to pass it? Do you have any feeling about that?
I'm in favor of that. I think people should be given that opportunity. I think it's a law of diminishing returns. I think if you've taken it twice and flunked, it might be difficult to get through the third or the fourth time. But I think they should have that opportunity. I don't think it's a very costly thing for the Board of Bar Examiners.
Do you have any early memories of the Oregon State Bar?
Not many, no. Other than the fact that by the time I graduated, we all became members of the Oregon Bar if we passed the bar exams.
Do you remember attending meetings?
No, I didn't. I was not very political in the bar, and one of the reasons was that in that day and age, I worked nights and weekends for law offices, and there was very little time for extracurricular activities in the political field. It's opened up vastly since I began. And I think one of the reasons Mr. Bulliman was elected president of the bar at such an early age is that he, I think, had something to do with the organization of the Oregon Bar at that time. But he had always been interested in the production, in the bar developments. And so I think that was one of the reasons. But I just didn't have time. And that, when, of course, I was with the, when I was with the SEC, there was no opportunity to engage in bar association activities, either in the state of Washington or the state of Oregon. We were busy working for the government. Then when I came back, again, I was the only associate with the firm, and Mr. Bulliman, Mr. Spackman, and Mr. Pendergrass dumped a lot of work on me, and I just had no time. With the only extracurricular activities that I engaged in, and this was over the years, was I did get on a lot of boards of charitable organizations here. The first one was the Travelers Aid Society, and nobody knows about that so much now, but that was in the war years, where they helped soldiers coming through at the railroads and so forth. And I was on the Travelers Aid Society board for about 6 years, I think. And then I became interested in the Portland Junior Symphony through a member of the board. And I was interested in music, and at that time, the conductor of the Portland Junior Symphony was Gershkovich. He was a Russian, and he had been the organizer, and he was the director. And I was on the board at the time we first interviewed a new applicant for directorship when Gershkovich resigned. And I remember our first interview with Jack Avshalomov, and he appeared before us, and he was finally selected as the director. And I became quite friendly with him. I've known him for years. And I think he's a little bit of a prima donna in certain ways, but he was awfully able and certainly a wonderful organization. And I didn't like it when they changed the name from Portland Junior Symphony to Portland Youth Philharmonic. Thought that was sort of getting a little towards the aggrandizement of the organization. Then I also got on the board of the Chamber Music Northwest when it was first founded. And I was on that for about 6 years.
Were you invited on the board?
Yes, I mean, people would get in touch with me and say, would you be interested in going on the board? And for example, I remember when I became a member of the board of the Catlin School, a friend of my wife's mother, Mrs. Elliot Corbett, was a member for a number of years, and she said, Charles, why don't you become interested in that? And so I went on that board, and I found that fascinating. That was most interesting board. And while I was there, Esther Strong, who was related to my wife through marriage, became the head of the Catlin School. That, later on, when the Catlin Gable School merged. I think she was on, was a director for a few years, and then she finally resigned. And I've already spoken about being involved in the merger of the Catlin School and the Gable School. And after that merger, Henry Cabell became the president of the combined schools, and he was an excellent president. He was a member of an old Portland family here. His mother was one of the Failing clan. There are three clans of the Failings. There were the rich Failings, the poor Failings, and the dirty Failings. And since my wife was related to the Failing clan, I got to know who the members of those various organizations were. Anyway,
what was the difference? Well, the original
The original Failing, I think, was Josiah Failing, and he had two sons. But for some reason or other, the eldest son, as in England, got most of the money, and then the younger son, and his family, and he had innumerable children, didn't fare as well as the children of the wealthy son. So that was why there was a division there. And then that dirty, I don't know where the dirty feelings came into the picture, but that was just an expression. Then I've been speaking of extracurricular activities. As I say, it wasn't in the Bar Association, it was in these other organizations. And I was a director of the City Club of Portland, and I got on that through Richard M. Steiner, who was the minister of the Unitarian Church here in Portland for many years, a remarkable man and very able. Later on, there was a sort of a schism in the art museum. The factions of the art museum were in dispute with the director of the art museum and the staff. That happens in these charitable organizations every once in a while. And someone said, get Mr. Wright on the board. Maybe he can pour a little oil on the troubled waters. So I got on the board there, and I was on the board there for 6 years of the art museum. And at one time, I remember Tom Stoll came to me and wanted me to act as president, and I just didn't have the time. I just couldn't have taken the time off to be president of the of that board, because that was a very time-consuming position. And finally, I think the last board I was on, in this sort of a moribund idea, Francis Adams, who was a friend of mine, was on the board of the Riverview Cemetery Association. He asked me to come on that board, and I said, oh, do you think I've got to that stage? And he said, yes. And so I went on that board. And I remember one beautiful day, we would have our meetings up at the cemetery office, near the chapel there. It's called the Adams Chapel. It was given in memory of Francis Adams' father, who was president of the First National Bank for many years. Anyway, I remember one of the board, it was a beautiful spring day, so we decided we'd go out. So we sat on tombstones and had our meeting.
But well, that's about taken care of.
Yeah. And as far as club memberships, I might as well go into that. I was a member of the Multnomah Athletic Club, and in fact, I've just resigned because I don't use it anymore. I joined when our children were small. We thought they'd use it a lot, but they didn't very much. Then I've been a member of the University Club for quite some time. That's where I try to make acquaintance with the associates in our firm by inviting them up for lunch.
It's very, very pleasant.
And I've always enjoyed that. And then I was asked to join the English Speaking Union, again by Mrs. Elliot Corbett, because she said that my father-in-law was on the English Speaking Union. Do you know what the English Speaking Union is?
No.
Well, it's an organization throughout the United States and in Great Britain. to promote friendship between the English and the Americans, and despite the fact that there's that language barrier we have. They're mostly elderly people who belong to the English-speaking Union, but we occasionally have very good speakers and from Oxford or Cambridge and so forth. Of course, I belong to the various bar associations, the Multnomah Bar, the Oregon Bar, the American Judicature Society, and two of the historical societies of the United States District Court Historical Society and the United States Supreme Court Historical Society. And I think Mr. Bullivant and I were the first ones who joined that United States Supreme Court Historical Society. And their bulletins are awfully interesting because generally it's quarterly with a larger bulletin than an annual bulletin, and they give the history of the early judges in those bulletins, and that's awfully interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Now takes care of my extracurricular activities, I think.
What did you hope for by being on all the boards, all of these boards? Did you have any?
I just was interested in music, and I was interested in education. And I thought that if there's anything I could do to stimulate interest in the people of Portland in these institutions, I'd like to do it. The Portland Art Association, I didn't have too much background in that, though I thought the Portland Art Association had done a very good job in their exhibitions and so forth. So that was really the reason I joined that board. But I had no mission other than to just try to spread the word, the gospel as it was. And I was awfully interested in Chamber Music Northwest when it first started, because it brought musicians to Portland during the summer. They just have the summer concerts at Reed and at Catlin School, and we've been attending the ones at the Catlin School because that's near our house. They have Monday, Tuesdays, and then Fridays, and then they have special ones on Saturdays, which occasionally we'll subscribe to those. But and they have just excellent musicians from all over the country, including my daughter Elizabeth, who played the harpsichord at two of the sessions with her husband, who played the violin. But lately, they've sort of dropped early music because they don't have the early music instruments in the group here. And to play the early music properly, the people who are in the early music movement think you should have the early instruments, and Elizabeth and her husband have formed a duo, and they give concerts in Europe, and they're going to be in Vancouver, BC this summer for a session.
Do you feel a sense of accomplishment that many of these organizations are still around today, and they're flourishing?
Oh yes, I think it's very gratifying to see that they are still going. And there's another organization. I don't think I was on the board. I think my wife is on the board. It's also chamber music, and that's been flourishing. And my wife can remember in the early days when practically no one was interested in chamber music as distinguished from orchestral organizations. I never did get on the board of the Portland Symphony Association because I was on the board of the Junior Symphony. No, I think that they've made, and there's still very active in all of these organizations. The only one that has sort of subsided was the Travelers Aid Society, because that was more of a war effort. I noticed there's something about the war effort.
Was the popular support for World War II, was that very important?
Oh, absolutely, and it was. In fact, I think though at first the general public didn't want to get involved in another European war, but as time went on and they saw what Hitler was doing, then I think they even embraced Roosevelt's ideas of the Lend-Lease program, which was really helping the British in a way that we couldn't. Roosevelt didn't have enough popular support at that time to actually make funds available for the war effort in England, but he worked around it by leasing war equipment to them, and the idea was they'd pay rental when the time came and so forth. So that was more palatable to the general populace, but closer we got to Hitler's domination, the more support came for our getting into the war, and then of course Pearl Harbor. That did it, because everybody then supported it. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was any dissident group that I can remember the way it was with the Vietnam War or the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. It was just a wholehearted support. Mm-hmm. And we all worked for various ways, and I think I've mentioned that when the Securities and Exchange Commission was given investigative powers, and that we made reports on places that could be bombed in Spain and Europe and in the Far East. Mm-hmm. And our reports then would go to the Office of Strategic Services. They were getting reports from other sources, I'm sure, probably duplicative, but nevertheless it was war work, and I was glad that to be doing it, because I had two children. I didn't want to get in the service and not be at home. And my only military experience, did I tell about my military experience? Was going to when I was in high school during the First World War, they had an organization called the Citizens Military Training Camp. And when I was a junior in high school, several juniors and I joined up for a summer. It was a summer program, and we went up to Fort Lewis and were inducted in the Army and went through training and so forth.
That was a boot camp.
But it was really a boot camp, and though I don't think it was as strict as it was if we'd been actually in the military, because we were sort of for young people getting interested in it. And
was the idea then that you'd go back and finish high school?
That's right. Oh, yes. It was not any idea that you'd go on. But later on, I think they might have expected that you would take ROTC at college, for example. Mm-hmm. Or if the war had gone on, we might have. We were talking about support of the World War effort.
Yes. You know. Can you tell me if you have any? Well, how did you personally feel when the Germans were bombing England?
Well, I was just outraged, for one thing, and then just terribly sympathetic, and I just thought that we ought to help England. It was standing alone at that time. France had fallen, and being of English heritage, I think I felt more strongly than maybe some other people, but I thought that Winston Churchill had done a magnificent job of rallying the country to fight on, and thought it was just imperative that we got in there and help defeat Hitler. Yeah.
Now, you joined the Bullivant firm in 1943, is that right?
Yes. I was down in Portland on vacation. I had been filing applications with various firms here to see if I could get back into private practice. I had reached the point and the SEC and I that the exciting years were more or less over. And furthermore, both my wife and I had roots in Portland, and we wanted to get back to Portland. So I did apply to various firms, and I think Mr. Hart was still living at that time, and he said that they did not have any opening in their firm for the time being. He said, why don't you try the Bullitt firm? I think they might need somebody. And so I did get in touch with Mr. Pendergrass, and then nothing happened. And then all of a sudden I got a telephone call when I was down in Gearhart, I think, with my family on a vacation trip, and I got a call to come in and have an interview. So I came in to Portland and met with Mr. Pendergrass and Mr. Spackman. Whether Mr. Bullitt was not available at that time, I'm not sure. But in any event, I had my interviews with Mr. Spackman and Mr. Bullitt.
And what was the firm name at that time?
Pendergrass, Spackman, and Bullitt.
Do you know how they formed that partnership?
I think that Mr. Pendergrass had been house counsel at the First National Bank or maybe it was the trust division of that bank at that time was the Security Savings and Trust. And then he had gone back into private practice and he wanted to form a firm, and he knew Mr. Spackman, and I guess he also knew of Mr. Bullitt. And so the three of them got together and formed that firm. And Mr. Zollinger, I think, had something to do with it. He was an independent lawyer here, and I think he may have had some association with Mr. Pendergrass. And later on, he became head of the legal department of the First National Bank. And years later, came back here and was of counsel to the firm. And he was a very outstanding person. Remember him very well.
Can you describe your interview with Mr. Pendergrass and Mr. Spackman?
They asked a lot of questions, and of course, I think we're a little put off by the fact that I was a Democrat, and they were staunch Republicans. And I said, well, after all, when I graduated from law school, we were in the depths of the Depression, and certainly the Republican president hadn't saved the country, and I thought it was time to vote for Roosevelt. So he was the first president I voted for, and I've stayed, and I thought he did a good job, and that's why I've been a Democrat ever since. And
so they asked you to justify that?
Well, not particularly, but The idea was explain what it was. And then also, by having been with the Platt firm, they wondered why I had left the Platt firm, and I told them about the they recalled too that there had been a partnership fight in the Platt firm, the two Platt brothers having established an enmity between them. And at that time I said that I had studied under William O. Douglas. I don't think that gave me any lift up, studying under William O. Douglas, but that's how I got the job, and that's why I left. I was always interested in the securities field, and I thought that would be a good place to go for a while before branching out into private practice again. And so they accepted that. And then I gave them some of the reports that I had done on various investigations that I had made in connection with the sale of securities and mining frauds, and then also one of the reports I'd done for the Office of Strategic Services. And I think after going through all that, they had just lost the only associate, Carlisle Roberts. He had joined the Navy. So they were without any legal help, really. And I think they were, I've used the expression, scraping the bottom of the barrel, and so I got hired. Anyway.
I can't believe that's true.
Anyway, it didn't take very long for me to become very active in the firm and I got along very well with all three of them, really.
Did they hire you there on the spot?
Yes, after that interview, yes, yeah.
Mm. When did you start work?
And then on September 1st, 1943, just about 50 years ago.
Almost, you know. Exactly.
And I immediately plunged into an awful lot of work. And we moved to Portland from Seattle, and that's when we went up to got this house up on Vista, or on Myrtle Street. And there was a lot of night work and a lot of weekend work because they were just swamped. And the firm was, Mr. Pendergrass was on the board of the First National Bank, and he was, and the firm were attorneys for the First National Bank. And so there was loads of banking work to do. That time, I think I mentioned this, that they didn't have title insurance companies, and the bank making loans had to have abstracts of title examined, and they were all examined in our office. And I'd come in the morning, and there'd be a stack of these abstracts that you had to go through and trace the title and be sure you didn't miss up on the probate of an estate, for example. It was almost like a bar examination going through those abstracts because it involved real estate law and inheritance laws and so forth to be sure that there wasn't a gap in the title. And then we would have to give the opinion to the bank whether they had a first lien on the property. And that was a vast amount of work.
I can imagine.
And then there were garnishments, and I had to handle all the garnishments of employees working for the bank. And then occasionally, I didn't get into litigation very much during my whole 50-year career, except when I was with the Platt firm. I think the first case I ever tried was for George Black. He was a trial attorney in the Platt firm, and he thought I should cut my eye teeth on a case. He thought it was a losing case. It was a case brought against a tavern known as, it was run by the, it's called the Three Singing Waiters, and a patron of the tavern had been hit in the eye and cut over in the head by a flying bottle, and he brought suit against the Three Singing Waiters, and we represented the insurance company. And the attorney for the plaintiff, I can't remember his name now, but George Black said, well, he's managed to have this case, it was a district court case, not a circuit court case, he's managed to get this case before Judge Olson, who is absolutely teetotaler, and he hates liquor. And he said, you're just dead in the water to start with. Anyway, I took the deposition of this plaintiff, and I asked him who he was with the night when he was at the tavern. And he said, his son. And I said, how old was your son? And he said, 13 or 14, I can't remember which it was. And so when the trial came, after the plaintiff's case, during the plaintiff's case, I cross-examined the father, and I asked him just one question, two questions. Were you with anybody at the time of this accident? And he said, yes. And I said, who was with you? He said, my son. I said, how old was he? Whereupon Judge Olson got up from the bench, went into his chambers, came back with his Bible, and then read a long lecture to the plaintiff and the plaintiff's attorney and dismissed the case. That was one of my first experiences.
That's a great experience.
Hoist by his own petard, as I say. Yeah. Trying to get that judge and he got the wrong one.
That's funny. Yeah. So you worked plenty of hours when you first started.
Yes. Yeah.
How did that affect your family life?
Well, I think my wife occasionally would get pretty discouraged about, you know, my having to go back to the office in the evening, or sometimes I'd get home for supper, sometimes I wouldn't. And then on weekends, I'd go down on Sunday occasionally, not just occasionally, but quite often. And so it did have an effect. At that time, we had just the two children, Frederick, who was born in 1940, and our daughter Hilda, who was born in 1942. And then later in 1949, we had our third child, who was, my wife thought maybe it might be twins, because I was a twin, but it wasn't twins, it was a girl, and she's the one who became the musician in the family. But it was a pretty strenuous time, and I remember I got sort of worn down, and Mrs. Bullivant met me on the street one day, and Mr. Bullivant reported to me the next day. She said, "What in the world are you doing to Mr. Wright? He looks like a wreck." Anyway, she thought that they had overworked me, I guess. But anyway,
did that have any influence on Mr. Bullivant?
I think it did have a little influence on Mr. Bullivant. But and then I had an examination by a doctor, and he said I should get away for 6 weeks. So, or 4 weeks, that was it. He said 2 weeks to wind down and then 2 weeks to recoup. And so we went down to a place called Tagg's Farm at Gearhart, and they had marvelous food at that. They took in paying guests. And so we spent that time down there. And I came back. And then things, we began hiring more people. And as a result, the workload became less, and things evened out.
Who was the next associate that was hired?
I'm trying to think whether it was Walter Pendergrass.
Now, is Mr. Pendergrass his father?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And let's see. And I think Jack Hoffman came in about the same time. Yeah, they came in at about the same time. And I didn't think it was an awfully good idea to have the son of a senior partner coming into the firm. I mean, I heard about this when I was in law school in New York, because one of my closest friends' father was a lawyer in New York, and I remember Bill telling me that the firms in New York had a sort of a gentleman's agreement. They did not hire their own sons into the firm. They would get them into another firm to start out, because they thought it made for trouble in the firm if the son gave it. So I expressed that view at a partnership meeting, and it was not received with very great enthusiasm. But
you were a partner at the